Okay, all right, so I'm gonna stand up for a little bit and tell you guys a little bit about the exhibitions that are on view and about the panelists, and then we'll sit down and have a discussion. So the first thing that I wanna do is say thank you to the Nebraska Arts Council for supporting these two exhibitions, and as well as the University of Nebraska Convocations Committee for providing funds to bring the panelists to Lincoln. And also thanks to all of the GPAM staff, Naomi, and Lisa for the events, and everybody else at the center for helping us get this together. So basically, this panel discussion came about in conjunction with the two exhibitions that are on view. And tonight, we're hoping to start a dialogue about how art and science can serve as a means of communicating issues in regards to conservation and stewardship of the Great Plains. So right now, we're surrounded by images from this grass earth. And this exhibition will be on view until May 28th. And it features work by Sebastian Chicanos and Robin Walter. They captured as part of their Rediscover the Prairie expedition. And you can see more of their images at rediscovertheprairie.org and more information about their travels that they'll tell you about. And so it depicts a marriage of art and science and poetry. And it aims to increase awareness of the critically endangered landscape and excite a deeper understanding, appreciation, and engagement with the natural world and our place within it. On view in the West Gallery behind you are photographs by Kate Schneider showing the proposed, now rejected, Keystone XL pipeline route in Nebraska and South Dakota. And it's paired with handwritten letters from residents of the region that they wrote to President Obama asking that he reject the pipeline, which so far he did, and hopefully that will stay. The landscapes address the unseen threat that the proposed pipeline posed to the land, and the accompanying letters address the relationship between the land and those who sought to preserve it. Her exhibition will be up until August 28th. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of information about the panelists. So Robin Walter grew up on the edge of the plains in Colorado Springs, where she developed an early relationship with the outdoors, exploring Colorado's vast open spaces. In 2003, she co-founded the Rediscover the Prairie Project, which documents the changing Great Plains landscape and the impacted ecosystems and communities it supports. The project has taken her across North America's grasslands to report on land issues and conservation issues in the West. Her writing has been published in the Huffington Post, and her photography has been exhibited at Montana State University, the Smoke Brush Gallery, and Colorado College. She received a Bachelor of Arts in Creative Writing at Colorado College. Our other panelist is Sebastian Chicanos, and he was born in Connecticut and currently lives in Paradise Valley of Southwest Montana. In 2012, he graduated from Colorado College with a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Science, and he co-founded with Robin the Rediscover the Prairie Project in 2013. And in 2014, along with Robin, they traveled 600 miles through the northern Great Plains on horseback to document the changing biological and cultural landscapes through photography, writing, and film. His work has appeared in exhibitions at Montana State University, Colorado College, and in the Huffington Post. Our guest on the panel is a Toronto-based photographer and educator. It's Kate Schneider. Her work is based on traditions of documentary storytelling and ethnography, and her most recent works focus on the impact that land and the socialized landscape have on individual and cultural identity in North America. Kate was recognized by the Magenta Foundation in 2013 and won a 2015 Flash Award competition. And she has recently shown her work at the Soho Photo Gallery in New York, the Society of Photographic Education in Cleveland, and on the floor of the United States Senate. She received a Master of Fine Arts in Documentary Media from Ryerson University and is an instructor of photography at Ontario College of Art and Design. And our final panelist is Bill Whitney, and he is the executive director of the Prairie Plains Resource Institute in his hometown of Aurora, Nebraska. He has a Bachelor of Science in Biology from Nebraska Wesleyan University and a Master's in Science in Limnology from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Along with his wife, Jan, and Kurt Tweed and Hal Nagel, Bill founded the Prairie Plains Resource Institute in 1980. PPRI is responsible for thousands of acres of prairie restoration and educational programming, including an award-winning summer day camp. Bill and Jan have received numerous conservation awards, including the Nebraska Wildlife Federation 2006 Conservationist of the Year Award. So those are the panelists. Okay, so we're really excited to have you all here. And we're going to start. I'm going to basically ask them a few questions to get the conversation started. And then after we go through a few questions, we'll open it up to the audience so you guys can ask them questions as well. Okay, are you guys ready? Okay. So the first question is, please share details about your work and the connection to environmental conservation issues in the Great Plains.
Hello? Yeah. Hi, okay. So the work that Robin and I have up, I'm Sebastian, by the way, in this room is from our 3-month ride across eastern Montana and into northeast Wyoming. And as Melinda explained, the idea is to draw attention to work being done there in grassland conservation, both by nonprofit organizations, government land agencies, and then also individuals, ranchers, farmers, just citizens of the plains. So we wanted to bring awareness and bring excitement to some of the beauty of the natural landscape that remains, and also showcase some of the threats as well. You can see we have photos of plowed native prairie over there. And the beauty of the natural grasses behind us, and trying to look at the complex issues from that perspective of aesthetics and.
First, I just want to say thank you all for being here. We're so excited to come. Adding on to that, the Great Plains is a landscape you can't cross without. Talking about the threats, and we wanted to ride across it and sort of see for ourselves what some of the numbers that you read when you're thinking about the prairie that remains and the prairie that has been plowed up, what that actually looks like on the ground. And so that was a big part of our impetus to set out is to put a face to those numbers and to see what actually is being lost, but also to take a celebratory approach as well, and to sort of showcase some of the amazing and subtle beauty, and not so subtle beauty, that exists in this landscape that not so many people know about. So that was sort of the birthplace of the project and its connection to conservation.
Hi, thank you all for being here tonight. First, I would like to thank the Great Plains Art Museum for bringing this work here and yours. And also, I would like to say that some of the people here tonight are participants in my project. So some of the fighters and landowners of against the Keystone XL pipeline are here today. They're over there. So if you want to make them blush, that would make me happy. You're blushing. So in terms of this project, I call it a love letter to the landscape, and it really is that in many senses of the word. My background is not from here. I come from Cleveland, Ohio originally. I now live in Toronto, one of the largest metropolitan areas in North America. So I don't have very much connection to the land in terms of my life history, but I felt really connected very quickly to the land in a way that I didn't quite understand at first. And so this work is about my personal connection to the land, but then also the individual voices of the landowners and their very intense desire to protect not only their own land, but protect the land for future generations. And so the work is about conservation, but in more of a holistic sense. So I don't know if I, so yeah.
Well, back, I'll take you way back to before 1980. Jan and I got out of school and moved back to my hometown near where she grew up on, in Clay County. What was informing us in our lives at that time was interest in science. We had gone to different, I'd gone to a field biology station in Minnesota, Lake Itasca, and was really into natural sciences. And then we both went to Cedar Point, which is Nebraska station in Ogallala. And that was exposed us to hands-on science learning, and so that fed the passion of education that, you know, you can just go outside and discover things. Floundering maybe a bit, we had to either find a way to make a living in Aurora or leave. And so we did a lot of different things to make a living, but probably one of the more impractical things was to start a nonprofit organization. And we had family around, and they were supportive in a way. My father incorporated us and everything. He was supportive. But at the same time, it was not probably the most practical thing. But we also developed an interest and a connection to people who were working to restore grasslands, mostly in the eastern part of the Corn Belt, Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois. And ironically, had to go there to see, you know, grass over my head, because there wasn't a lot here in eastern Nebraska due to certain land use types and everything. But the interest grew. The idea of restoration, which actually started in the Madison, Wisconsin, the Chicago area, was fascinating. We came back here along the Platte River and discovered we had prairies, started picking seeds. And so the mission of the Institute was to do restoration, and we kind of applied it to a lot of things, not just plants. It was about rediscovering where you lived, or discovering for the first time, and teaching others about that. So gradually we hung on with the Institute and developed restoration processes to plant larger areas. And this kind of took off in the early 90s, along with an educational program. To make a long story short, we've had great success. We've received gifts of land. We've become land managers. Some of that involves farming. Some of it involves ranching. The concept of prairie plains has broadened, and the cultural context has gotten more interesting and deeper too, which is kind of where we're at now. I'll drop it with that.
Okay, so the next question is going to be for the artist, and then I have a question for Bill in a little bit as our scientist. But how do you see your art promoting conservation?
I guess we turned it off. I think it's sometimes it's so common in conservation to talk about the way that we've affected the land, and of course that you have to talk about that. But I think a big part that maybe is missing to that is like the way that the land affects us. And so I think that is how I see my work tying into that larger puzzle, and not only talking about the negative impacts we've had on the land or the positive impacts, but really talking about the way that, you know, the two-way street of that relationship, and talking about how it has such a profound and deep impact on like the individual level, which I think some of my poetry speaks to. It's just like my very personal encounter of intimate moments that that meant something to me. And I think sharing those relationships is an important piece of the puzzle and being in understanding that the relationship goes both ways, and we can't miss that piece of the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in terms of how my work promotes conservation, the interesting thing about this work is that it's looking at lands that are managed. So it is promoting conservation, but it's also very much promoting the idea of preserving, in a way, it's different than conservation, but similar, but preserving what amazing resources that are here within the Great Plains, within Nebraska, within South Dakota, and so forth, especially in regards to the Ogallala Aquifer and the Sand Hills, because many of us in this room, I'm assuming, know about the Sand Hills and know about the unique ecosystem of the Sand Hills. But in addition to the unique ecosystem, there's also a very unique culture that is part of, that has been sort of founded within that system. And what I found as an artist specifically was I was really interested in how the landscape indelibly shaped the culture of the place. So yes, the work does speak to conservation, but how the person who views the work takes conservation is really up to them. The true strength of thinking about conservation is not necessarily in the photographs themselves, but definitely in the words of the letters of the individual landowners, because within their individual words, you're able to get a more personal look at how the land affects their life, and not just their life, but because many of these people are food producers, affects your life as well. And you know, by preserving these things, keeping it safe from environmental issues or pipelines, as it were, they're having a vested interest in trying to preserve it so we all have a safe life, safe food resources and water resources.
So when you're traveling by horseback and moving 3 miles an hour, you're slowing down a lot, and you're taking a pretty close, detailed look at things. And you know, one of the things that a lot of people asked us when we were sort of dreaming up this project is, who's your audience? You know, who are you trying to speak to? And we never really made up our minds. but I think that's one of the cool things about it, is that we can take this show and show it to people in New York or in LA who have never been to any of the Great Plains or any of the Midwest, or you know, if they have, they've flown over it, and open their eyes up to it as outsiders. But then we can also show it to people who grew up here and who maybe have lived in the Great Plains their whole lives, but hopefully haven't quite seen it from this perspective, unless there's anyone out here who's ridden across the plains horseback, which there are a few probably. But that idea of actually showing an outsider's perspective on it as well, a traveler's perspective, and looking at that beauty in that detail, and trying to both gain the interest of the wider community of this country in preserving and thinking about the grasslands, and then the local people's interests, and having those conversations with the people we met along the way, and then sharing that story within the plains.
It's okay, now it's working, sorry. So this is your expert opinion, Bill. So how do you see art, maybe what's in the galleries today, or other types of art, as a means of promoting conservation efforts coming from a non-artist background?
Well, I had some coaching on this question too. Let me give you a little background. We were very science-y when we got out of the university. And that's informed a lot of what we do and how we do it in terms of lands, working with Prairie as a management system. But I also want to say that when we moved back home, there were artists there who called themselves artists, but there were also people who just did their daily thing of writing or working a trade or whatever, who we came to think of as artists as well. But what began to inform us then was this totality of kind of consciousness and skill and living out in the land. And part of it's agrarian, a big part of it, but then having artists out there who are, you know, painting or doing crafts of one type or other, who are seeing it differently and are part of the community, not, you know, they're not, they're as at home there as I am. Some of them who've lived there a long time. Of course, you know, you're never accepted after 30 years if you're an outsider, but, you know, anyhow, the artists are very important, and I've considered myself an artist with Prairie Restoration on a bigger canvas. It's in working in slow motion over the time of seasons and watching seeds grow and things eat the plants, you know, all these things that are happening. It's a process thing, and I think that's art. And in fact, with one of our young employees, he was a high school kid at the time, his name was Titus. There was a discussion in the truck once about whether this Prairie Restoration could be art. And I had the discussion with him. I wasn't in the truck at the time, but we had a good discussion about that. And art can be a lot of things. But it's neat when you can talk about those things and see the connection between perception and real life.
Okay, great, thank you. I like the idea that art can be anything. So, okay, the next question is a big compound question, so bear with me. So, do the Great Plains present unique challenges for using art to promote conservation and communicate scientific issues? And what are those? And so, for example, we can't readily see the impact of art agriculture or overgrazing in the Great Plains in the same way that images of clear-cutting forest or drilling for oil may more readily illustrate environmental harm. So how does this difficulty affect your work? And I think this relates to trying to do scientific, bring awareness to scientific issues as well as trying to depict it in art forms.
I can start if you guys want. Sure. I always say with my project, the Goliath in the story doesn't exist, and thankfully won't exist. But as a photographer, that creates a really unique problem. It's like, how do you do a story about something that's not there? How do you photograph something that's not there? Well, for me, what I found was really interesting, and I always like to put to people, is that, you know, when you look at a photograph, you're always looking at something that has been there. It's always there and will always be in this particular photograph. In terms of these photographs, you're looking at it and saying, what could be there and what could happen? And so all the individual photographs were taken either directly on the route itself or very near or adjacent to the route. So whether it's, you know, saying, hey, the pipeline would go right where these feed bunks are, you could think about how, you know, the trees will be gone or that pasture won't be there. And in similar things that you could think about it in other ways, or how does the pipeline, not just in physically changing the land, but how does it physically change the culture of that place? Because, you know, this is a very, typically very agrarian society, agricultural society. And when you start taking things in that are foreign to the society, that are, you know, and bringing in new people, how does that change the cultural arrangement of things? So yeah, I'm asking a lot from my viewers, and I want the viewers to ask a lot of questions, but I think that's, for me, the importance of photography. For me, photography isn't about saying, look at this. Photography for me is about saying, hey, what could be going on here? What else is going on here? What other questions is it making you think of or remind you of? So that's how I was attacking it from that point of view. The other thing is, since most people have never been to the prairies, I had never been prior to doing this work, I wanted the person to sort of have an emotional attachment to a place that they have never been to. And so I wanted to photograph it in a way to kind of give that emotional attachment and that feeling. Maybe I was successful, maybe I wasn't, I don't know, but that was my main goal, to have the person sort of feel something that they didn't really know that they could feel about a place.
I think in a lot of ways, numbers can fall flat if there's not a story behind them. And so I think that's a wonderful thing about storytelling, is that it gives a face to, you know, we're bombarded every day with however many species that are disappearing and X amount of prairies being plowed under, and like you look at the number and some of the science, and if you're not a scientist, what does that actually mean? And so I think like art is a great way to address that. Like, what does that mean? And what are the stories behind it? And who are the people involved? And whose lives are affected? And what are the insects that are being affected? And like, how do they affect anyone around them? Or in a way that is and being able to tell those stories in a compelling way, I think is a great tool to use in sort of this conversation of conservation. And you know, a lot of the species that we photographed, like if you don't look so closely and you don't like, pipits aren't, you know, like the sexiest birds. They're over there, they're in a nest there. I think they're really sexy. But you know, like the average human being probably doesn't think they're so sexy, but being able to showcase some of the more subtle aspects of how cool these birds are and the stories behind them, I think is a great way that art can, you know, add to the conversation. And you know, like, you know, art, science, like we could use some like interpretive dance, like whatever, you know, it's such a complex and like nuanced thing that we're faced with, that I think any, you know, art, science, like whatever, let's put it all on the table, and I think that they can only help each other. So any interpretive dancers out there, please feel free to come up.
Yeah, Robin and I were actually looking along our whole route for some dancers to join in, accompany us along the plains. But I do think that there are some unique challenges in photographing or documenting in any form of art some of the beauty of the Great Plains. It's you end up with a lot of landscape photos and a lot of close-ups of flowers. But I think that even though that is a challenge, it's also, you know, an opportunity to find a new perspective, a new light on things. And also, one of the things that we were thinking about was how to balance, you know, romanticizing certain motifs of the cowboys, you know, or whatnot going across the plains, and how much, you know, are our sunset shots sort of depicting, you know, an ideal versus what was actually there. And it's, you know, it's a question that you have to play with a lot as an artist, too, is, you know, okay, so I'm going along and I could take this photo in this direction and there's going to be a big power line going through it, or I could turn a little bit and make it look like there's totally, you know, unfenced, pristine, you know, virgin prairie with no fences in it or something. And we did a little bit of both. We played with both things. I don't think that there's a perfect answer. Sometimes we wanted that ideal, to have people think about what they could strive for, or what, you know, what might inspire them. And sometimes we wanted to have a little bit more of that sort of real modern day messiness of power lines or, you know, a cowboy on his smartphone, you know, trying to make his business deals or something. So there's that balance. And it can be tricky, but it's a fun challenge too.
You know, people aren't always rational and logical. I think that the window to curiosity and understanding is aesthetic. It's emotional. And a lot of people in the state who've lived here all their lives know the state's beautiful, but they won't say that to anybody. And we had a person who observed our kids program 1 year. And the comment was that we've given the kids a license to think it's pretty and to say it. Because we don't teach our kids to look at something and say, that's beautiful. And that's, artists do that. We make no apologies for that in our work.
Okay, great, thank you. Okay, so here's a kind of lofty question. Do you view your work either as an artist or as a scientist as environmental activism?
I'll start. definitely not environmental activism, because I just think that where we live, nobody would ever listen to you. I've been called the bird guy or the plant guy for so long, you know, it's just not productive to be an activist. I tend to look at what we do as community development. It's everybody as important as you know, bricks and mortar, because it deals with perception about where we live, and I think that's the key to sustainability. So, no, you can't be an activist. You just have to hang around a long time and keep doing the same things.
I can speak to this. In terms of this particular project, I do consider this to be an activist project, and I'm glad to say that. In terms of my own work, I'm hesitant to call myself a visual activist. I have some friends who do in terms of their own work, but I would like to say that even though I'm hesitant to call myself a visual activist, my work is very much rooted in the world. And I tend to think of this, I'm gonna butcher the quote, so I'll do a poor job of it, but there's an artist named Alfredo Yar. And in his work, very political work, but he says that essentially all artwork is politically driven work. It's socially driven work. And if it's not socially driven or politically driven, then it's just ornamentation. And that's how I view my own practice, that yes, sometimes it has a much more activist bent than others, but still the subtext of all of the work that I do has a political bent to it, because I am a thinking, engaging person within a community structure, and I can't divorce that from myself. And I think not all work, like there's lots of work out there that is amazing that isn't politically driven, but at least in terms of myself, it would be disingenuous for myself to make work that doesn't take on that kind of tack.
You know, I think one of the things that defines what we did was that it's asking as many questions as it was trying to answer questions and solutions. We were trying to learn as much as we were trying to teach along the way. And I think that, so yeah, I mean, I don't know if you'd call that activism or not. We're trying to get other people to ask those questions with us answer those questions within their local communities, within the regional communities, and as a country, you know, how do we want this landscape to be managed? How do, you know, for individuals, how do I want my own ranch to be managed? what are the goals? What are the values that we consider important? So, you know, I guess Robin and I probably have our own personal political stances on individual projects or institutions or proposals like the Keystone XL. But our goal, I guess, is to more, like Bill was saying, have people think about their sense of place and raise that sort of pride in their own sense of place so that they can come together as communities and discuss that and make decisions for themselves.
Sure, why not? Absolutely. I think that, you know, like was the first sentence out of my mouth when we knocked on a rancher's door. Like, hi, we're environmental activists. Like, you know, I have this boy from Connecticut with me. Like, I'm a poet. Like, no, like that wasn't our approach. I think our goal first was to be seen as human beings that shared an interest in this thing that they also loved and cared deeply about, and we wanted to help tell that story. So, you know, our approach wasn't environmental activism. Do we hope that this will play a part in a larger conversation and in protecting the prairie? Yes, absolutely. Of course.
Okay. I'm okay with that. I was just curious what you guys thought. I think it's okay to be environmental activist and political activist and art activist, which I think you are in your own way, even if you don't want to admit it. From the art historical's perspective. So I'm going to jump a little bit ahead so we have time for questions. But this is kind of an opinion piece, but I think you've talked about this a little bit in some of your other answers. But for each of you personally, particularly since we're in the Center for Great Plains Studies and the Great Plains Art Museum, why is the Great Plains worthy of conservation?
I can start. I'm assuming all of us eat and drink water, and so therefore, that's why it's worthy of conservation. I mean, that's a very glib answer, so please excuse that. So I'll say it in a better way. But it's quite frankly, I mean, the Ogallala Aquifer, one of the freshest, cleanest aquifers in our country and largest, that feeds many of the farmlands around here. The sandhills used to be known as the Great American Desert, as many of you know. And the area, I don't know if much of you know about the sandhills, but it's actually really quite fascinating in many senses. But when settlers first came out here, they just thought this was like nothing. Like, no one should be here. This is not worthy of having anyone to work on the land. And then part of the reason why the sandhills have become so stable is through ranching practices, and definitely rotational grazing and all of those things, which you obviously can speak more about. And it's made the land a much more sort of stable place. But then part of it, because of that, it just the amount of food and other things, now ethanol, that comes out of this region is mesmerizing. And I think it's something that not all of us really truly understand. Part of the reason why I became interested in this project is, even as a young child, I've always really kind of liked cows. I know, I never told you that, Bonnie. And I think it was really just an excuse for me to get to know cows better, because I always wanted to know where my food came from. And unfortunately for my parents and my friends, they've heard way too many cow stories. But, you know, and I think for me, that was sort of the biggest thing, is just to understand the, you know, the farm-to-table thing. We all talk about it, it's a trendy thing, but you can see it on a daily basis out here in Nebraska. So that said, I find that, yes, the Great Plains are really important to take care of and support, but there are so many environmental issues across the board. I'm from the Great Lakes, and the Great Lakes are heavily polluted, invasive species, you name it. And I also do some work just more on the ground, like digging up stuff and like helping salmon up there. But again, it's like very unique ecosystem that, you know, I think we all need to start doing our part to protect. So I'll stop on my soapbox.
I wrote a poem about this, actually, and I can't really remember it, but I'll try. I think if you want, you can go read it. Although it's long been established, nobody can read my handwriting aside from a very select few, so you probably can't read it, actually.
But we do have printouts and plain text in the back if you want to, if you can't read her handwriting. It's really not that bad.
Anyways, it goes something like this, that the things we saw matter not because they're disappearing, which they are, but because the feelings they excite count, because we are part of, because we belong to every part of this place, and we are part of the bird song and the glint of light in the blue stem, and we're part of a delicate balance that we've caused a shift in, and we're tasked with assigning value to that, and this is, we belong to this, we're tied into its story as it's tied into ours. So those aren't words word for word, but I think the general idea is that we're part of it.
Robin said it much more eloquently than I will. But I do think, especially since the question that was asked, I believe, was why is it personally important to me, I think that's what it comes down to, is personal connections that I feel with the landscape now and with individual species. It's true. I assume a lot of you that are here today already care about the prairies, and that's why you're here. But I do think it makes a huge difference, and you know, in the work that Bill and Jan do, getting kids out into the outdoors and teaching them some of the individual species, that you, when you learn the name, you know, of this plant or that insect or that bird, you care a little bit more about it than when it's just kind of greenery on the side of the highway. And when you spend time actually in a place, getting to know those individuals, getting to know their names, you know, shaking their hands, so to speak, and then you care about them, well, it says friends. And so that's what it comes down to for me. I mean, it's also all of this sort of like, and we need to eat, you know, and we need to drink. There's some practical matters too. But even if we could eat and drink in a system of entirely, you know, domesticated plants and animals that was just, you know, very low diversity, it wouldn't be as interesting and as fun. And a lot of those individuals would be lost.
To me, when we were first learning about prairie on more than just a, you know, superficial level, I think the history really hit us. The connection to history and to writing like Wright Morris and Mari Sandoz, and if anybody's read Jim Harrison's books, Set in Nebraska. You know, I'm less of a scientist and more of a romantic, not, you know, romance in the sense of the story and the depth. As a scientist, what's fascinating to me is just the time scale and the space and the way things move about. Now, people are part of that more now. But in terms of the native ecosystem, that is pretty wild and crazy. I mean, it's a cosmic place. It's aesthetically, as somebody long ago described, it's like a sledgehammer. You don't know it's there until it hits you. And there's something there that's really outstanding and strong. And I think, you know, it's such a big part of the American character as we, you know, understand that myth of the people that were here first and everything that's happened in the last few hundred years. So all of that can be conserved if we want to. if we are ignorant, we can, you know, pretty much fritter most of it away and be poor for it.
Okay, great. Thank you, guys. Thanks for sharing your stories. So does anyone in the audience have questions for anyone? And if you do have a question, wait for me to come around and I'll bring the microphone so everyone in the room can hear you. So any questions?
Well, I have both a question and a comment, and I'll make the comment first because I've known Bill Whitney and Jan for several years now and have become somewhat active in Prairie Plains. And he's way too modest. He is an actual artist as well as a sculptor of the plains. But they also, I think, brought flyers tonight. So if anyone wants to support their mission, I hope that will be available. And then I had a question. I'm sorry I've forgotten your name next to Robin, but you said you grew up in Connecticut and then went to Colorado College. And I wondered if there was something in the mythology of the plains or the mountains that brought you there, or?
Sure. I did. I grew up in Connecticut, and I went to college in Colorado. I think there was something in the mythology that brought me out. I mean, from the time I was a kid, I was always reading, you know, cowboy books, and was fascinated by learning about Native American cultures. And then on road trips, you know, as a young teenager, and actually going through the Great Plains and through the West, I just totally fell in love with it and knew that I had to come back. And then once I was, but you know, I will say I probably ended up at Colorado College more for the mountains than the plains. That's sort of what definitely drew me there, to be honest. But once there, it was interesting, and a lot of my fellow classmates, you know, every weekend they were going into the mountains, and it was all about the mountains and going skiing, mountain biking, trout fishing, rock climbing up in the mountains. And it was a while until I discovered you could drive east on a weekend too, and go out into eastern Colorado, and there was some really cool stuff out there too, and a lot less people, which was really fun. And I ended up doing some undergraduate research on some remnant tall grass prairie along the Front Range in eastern Colorado. And spending that summer out there doing, you know, transects in the grass, and spending that time in the grasslands really was the turning point for me when I fell in love with it. And then, you know, later on, that sparked the whole interest in doing this project, and spending that more time, you know, definitely deepened that interest. But
any other questions?
I recently participated in a presentation by someone who is a marketing expert for nonprofits. And his advice on selling ideas was to always start with the ugly that you're going to fix. So, you know, he was giving examples. If you're a nonprofit doing medical, you start with dying children, and you show those, and you let people imagine what it is you're going to do. I mean, I'm being kind of obnoxious by putting it that way, but I've tried and tried to think how you would apply this to this kind of a movement. Part of the problem, it seems to me, is that you can't show the ugly and ask people to imagine the beauty because most people don't know the beauty. So you have to show them the after as well as the before. Anyway, I'd like your comment on that. Let me make it more general. How do you market these ideas to people and get them to support restoring prairies, for example, voting down pipelines?
I think I can speak to the first part of that question. I haven't figured out how to market it. I mean, that's a big challenge. But I think it's actually, or I personally think the opposite approach is as effective, if not more. Show the pretty first. Like, show all of the things that stand to be saved rather than what has already gone to the plow or to a poorly developed pipeline. I think it's as important to show everything that stands to be saved. And I think that it's actually quite easy in some of these photos to show the ugly if you look closely. I mean, a lot of this is like plowed up native prairie, and the difference in like the geometry and everything is really stark when compared to its native complexity.
Well, in terms of my project, I guess the question is like, why not show the pipeline more or less? Or, because no, it's a really good question. It's something. Right, or even show, but there is the Keystone One pipeline, which is in Nebraska right now. Honestly, I wasn't interested in showing the what is, because I personally find that really boring. Like, there's so many photographs of like, hey, there's a backhoe, and there's some prairie, and yay. But for me, what was much more interesting was the sort of complex negotiation between the culture, the land, that linkage, and then also kind of sort of visually showing this is why these folks don't want this pipeline on their land. Look what could happen. And so in a way, I'm kind of doing that, but it's in a very kind of oblique way. I realize that. Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm asking a lot for the viewer. I totally understand that. But I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to do. And I quite frankly just really kind of fell enwrapped with the landscape that I wanted to kind of show what I found was so amazing. So, thank you.
I'll take a stab. I'm still trying to figure out the answer to your question after 36 years. It's hard to market. But I do know that we have a saying in our little staff culture of, when things get really ugly or down, we just put another board on the barn. We just keep, you know, adding. There are so few examples out there in our culture who's basically the media and the spin out there goes to the negative so fast, and we really have a dearth of positive examples on almost anything. I mean, tell me when you've read a positive example of a classroom, an educational thing. The media doesn't have many of those. And that's why we keep doing SOAR, because it feeds our need to do something positive. And it's hard to market, but we can't change. And our message is, let's create positive examples. I mean, and I'm not so different activist-wise. We're activists in a different context of the word, but we're all activists. I think we just have to keep pushing against some of the negative pressures.
Good question.
Yeah. Anyone else? Okay. Hold on, George.
Well, I've supported your operation for some years, and I'm relieved to hear you modify your view about being an activist. You've done this for a long time, and therefore you've survived. How have you managed to do that?
Oh, I don't know. I think about that every day. We've had a lot of good supporters, and a lot of our peers in the work itself know more about us than a lot of the average people out there. We've had a lot of support that way. We found a little niche in the prairie restoration that we found a revenue stream for. But I think it goes back to fundamental beliefs that we started with. I mean, we were friends with Norris Alford, a very forthright newspaper editor, last of his kind. And the ideas of thrift, the agrarian ideas of thrift and community, whether we always live out those ideas isn't the point, is that we aspire to them. And I think when times get hard, you just hunker down and stay at it. That's how you survive.
But you've also succeeded in having people grant you land, which mm-hmm. would indicate that they've perceived what you're doing as something worthwhile, and they want to be part of it.
And, you know, there are some people in our staff that think it's providence, but I don't know how to address that. But it's been an uncanny ride. It's been amazing. And I don't know. I mean, it's you know, the subject matter we work with is so interesting. I think that's a motivator. And trying to do something where it hadn't happened before is a motivator. You know, when we did SOAR, our summer camp for kids, there wasn't one. Right. So we could do whatever we wanted to. And that gives you a lot of freedom as an artist or whatever you do, an entrepreneur. And but no, there's no magic bullet. It's just make something happen and hope it works.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Question, comment?
Sorry, I haven't actually gone through all the pictures with the horses and so on, but I'm reading a book by Bill Bryson right now, and he's walking around and looking at England, and there's no barbed wire anywhere. How do you get around on your horse?
We opened a lot of gates. A lot of gates that we opened. We got really good at it. And it was a tricky endeavor because, you know, we had like a pack train of like four horses and, you know, a dog to juggle and a camera, and it required a fair amount of acrobatics, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it's tricky. We also carried a pair of fencing pliers with us. I mean, a number of landowners said, like, you have fencing pliers, right? Like, you're going to need them to get through my land. And, you know, we would build back up any fences that we took down better than we had found them. So we did have to do that a number of times, which is not an easy endeavor. But we were riding along public roads most of the time, county roads. And you'll find that most of the cattle guard gates along county roads will have a gate next to it that you can open up to let livestock through, but some of them don't. So that's a law that I think should be changed around the country. Required passage for horseback travelers or along all county roads. But there's a lot of barbed wire, and it's interesting, you know, thinking about the challenges that we faced versus the challenges that, early pioneers or Native Americans would have faced. We had a lot of barbed wire to deal with. That was probably one of our biggest issues. On the other hand, we had a lot of stock tanks with water where there wouldn't have been water. So there's kind of, you know, there are a lot of rattlesnakes now, and there probably were a lot of rattlesnakes then, but Yeah.
Okay, we probably have time for one more question.
This is a couple of comments, but the group, the panel can respond to them. The first thing has to do with George Wolf's question. I'm Paul Olson. I went to Aurora in 1979-80 when Bill Whitney and Jan were just talking about the Prairie Plains Resource Center. They had read some books about ecology and they were going to restore grasslands. And I can say it's a miracle. I wouldn't have given, if they'd asked me to lay a bet of 1,000,000 to 1 as to whether they were going to succeed, I would have refused the bet because I didn't think they had that much of a chance. So it's extraordinary. The other thing that I wanted to say was I think the fact is that for most young people, art teaches them to hate the plains in this respect, that if you look at Renaissance landscapes or if you look at the Impressionists or early 20th century landscape artists, for the most part, they apotheosize woodlands, mountains, things like that. It's not accidental, I think, that you went to Colorado Springs to see the mountains, because that's what we're taught. I grew up in northern Wisconsin. I had counter art all around me that said, the mountains are beautiful, everything else is ugly. And when we came back, my father had to quit farming when I was 12. When we came back to Nebraska, I thought it was incredibly ugly. The landscape, this was World War II, and the landscape was very eroded. And I didn't see the beauty of grasslands. So that it wasn't until I began to take painting with in Lindsberg, Kansas, with a painter named Charlie Rogers, another named Berger Sanzane, who painted the Great Plains, and I had to start to look. And I think part of the problem, and I appreciate any response that you have, is that we do not ask children, young people, to paint or draw or photograph in a way that's attentive to what's going on in grasslands. And I think that might make a difference.
Well, I personally get claustrophobic when I'm in the mountains. I know it's, I've never really liked the mountains. It's just always, I've never really seen the allure. But, you know, I think that's a really interesting question about like having young children paint or photograph or make work about the grasslands. I actually think, more importantly, getting children to make work about the land in front of them. Yeah, for children here, yeah, the grasslands. For children from where I'm from, the Great Lakes or wooded areas. I think there isn't enough seeing and appreciating what we actually have. So yeah, I think that's a great point. And you know, it's really interesting what you said about how children are taught to not value the plains. Because what I find is really interesting about that statement is, yeah, you're probably right. But at the same point, the plains are like one of the most unique aspects of North American identity. The cowboy, the barbed wire fences, you know. And what I always find is funny, or not funny, but interesting, is that Europeans, like when they think of America and their sort of like mythical America, what they think of is this. And yet what we think of as our mythical America might be, you know, New York City, which is quite interesting. And just sort of says to how we as a society are valuing land in a more general sense.
Sure, I think it's a great idea to get kids out there and to draw and paint in the plains and maybe not even bring their cameras. Sometimes I hated sometimes having my camera because I was looking through a lens at this, what you can't view through a lens. You know, that's the rub. And so, you know, go lay in it. Don't bring your pencil. Just go take a nap in the pasture. Like that's a great solution. Everybody should take naps. More naps is my. And you know, it's not only children. It's even. I think there's a monotony to working with the land that creates a certain lens that you then view it as something to be managed or stewarded or protected or not protected or transformed or bettered or anything, you know, instead of just looking at it as what's there in front of you. And so I think we could all benefit from changing those lenses or putting the lenses down and taking more naps.
I'm good.
I'm gonna second the naps comment for sure. I'm for taking more naps. Did you all have anything else you wanted to add? Okay, I think we'll call it a night. Don't forget that on your chairs, there's a free gift from the Center for Great Plains Studies, Roaming the Plains. It's about our ecotourism program that the Center for the Great Plains is studying. So as part of our 40th year anniversary of the Plains, we're giving you all a book. So enjoy, and thank you for coming.
I just want to quickly thank everyone for coming. It's such a thrill to be here, and thank you so much for coming out.